Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD Cast, the only podcast that is live and indirectly from Providence, Rhode Island via Columbus, Ohio. As always, I'm your guest, John Orlando, and this is a historic edition of the PVD Cast. Why, you may ask? Because I'm not doing it from my home, from my palatial estate in Westerville, Ohio. No, no, I'm doing it on the road. That's right. How? Well, that's for Orlando's faves at the end of the show. But anywho, with me, I'm in the very beautiful home, by the way.
Thank you.
With me is a man that has a very prestigious title. And I've had champions on this podcast before, but I have never had a New York Times best-selling author joining me on this edition of the PVD Cast, Dara Naragi. Dara, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Before we jump into things, I'm just going to give a little precursor.
All right.
As I've done many times on this podcast, and I know my target audience is very wrestling-related, but like I did a couple weeks ago, we're changing things up, as I am a person that really believes that independent ideas, independent spirit, independent things are the way to go. That's why it was a natural fit for you to come on here, since you are an independent comic book creator, and I know you just have a very big book that just came out, your first multi-volume book. Yeah. And I know you want to talk about it, so that's why I thought it'd be easy to have you come on and talk a little bit about it. So, for those folks that are my quote-unquote usual, I just use air quotes and anyone can see.
That's not going to work.
Anyways, for you folks that are my usual audience, I say stick with it. You know, you'll get to hear some interesting tales, some interesting things on here. You know, it may not be really heavy on pro wrestling this week, but I think still it's going to be a very entertaining podcast. And with that, since I've set the bar so high, New York Times bestselling author, wow, Dara Naragi. Where's your plaque?
You know what? They actually don't give you one. Can
what?
You believe that? I know.
You're
I know.
Kidding me.
Yeah, nothing. I had to print out a copy from the web.
Really?
Yeah. No, not really. Oh. No plaque.
No plaque. Wow, okay. I would assume that nothing at all. Not even like a quick email saying, hey, congrats, nothing.
No.
They don't care.
Nope, they don't at all. But I will say this is kind of interesting. So I've had two graphic novels that ended up on the bestseller list, and I'll be truthful and humble here and say that most of it had to do with the fact of what the property was and not so much my name on it, but that's besides the point.
Well, let's just go ahead and talk about it. What are those two properties that got you on that list?
So the first one was I did the official movie prequel graphic novel for Terminator Salvation, which was the Terminator movie that came out a couple of years ago. And so the funny thing with that was I was actually back in Iran with my family visiting my grandma when that thing hit the bestsellers list. And I was checking my email, you know, I had kind of sporadic internet access, and I was checking it after a week, and there was an email from my publisher, IDW Publishing, saying, hey, congratulations, we just found out that the book's gonna debut on the bestseller list, so now you can add that to your title. So it was just kind of cool. I thought that, you know, I was thousands of miles away, I wasn't even here when I found out about it. So that was the first one. And then the second book was called Witch and Wizard. And it's actually it's an original graphic novel that I wrote, but it's based on characters from a James Patterson young adult novel series called Witch and Wizard.
Now, did James Patterson have anything to do with the creative process for that? For that particular book, or no?
Only in so much as he would, he had final say over everything in terms of plot and even dialogue and characters and all that, but no, it was basically all me in terms of coming up with the story and okay, writing it.
And you didn't run into any roadblocks from Patterson? He didn't go, no, this is crap, you're not putting this in here. What are you doing?
No, there are a couple of bumps in the road, I guess I would say, and it was one of the folks that works for him that handles multiple properties, and I think at the time We were doing the graphic novel based on the books. He was working on, you know, the third book in the series. And then they were also shopping it around in Hollywood, and it was optioned for a movie. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, either shortly after or shortly before, they had like a manga series that was a straight up adaptations of the book. So they're all in the works. So this guy that was coordinating all of this, you know, he kind of had a few points that he wanted changed, and Luckily for me, my editor at the time at IDW was Bob Schreck, who's for you know, those folks that are really into comics, they may recognize his name. The guy's been everywhere. I mean, he's worked at Dark Horse and DC and Vertigo and just with all the big names. I mean, Frank Miller and all the way down. Anyways, he was my editor, and he really went to bat for me, and he said, you know, all the stuff that you guys are pointing out are just kind of minor points in it. Let's not get hung up on these. And so I didn't really have to deal with a lot of that, which was nice.
Now, what about the Terminator Salvation book? Did they also pretty hands-off?
Or yeah,
were they like, you can only, you know, tweak this and that, you can't, you know?
The other than the fact that, you know, at the very beginning they said, we want the book to focus on new characters and have John Connor in it, but in a minor role, because really we want the movie to be his story. So for the graphic novel, we sort of want it to be leading up to the, you know, where the movie starts, but don't focus too much on him. Outside of that directive, they were pretty hands off, and I was really surprised, because I mean, that's a big property, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I'd worked on a couple of other sort of movie tie-in things, but they're very small. And I had good experiences with those too, but I kind of thought going into this one that it was going to be maybe a little bit rough, maybe a little stressful.
Yeah, is that a Fox property?
No.
Who has Terminator?
Well, at the time, it was a production company called Halcyon, and I don't know which movie studio produced it, but these guys owned the rights.
Okay.
But yeah, and I'd heard, you know, I had other friends in the comic, comic industry, I guess, that have worked on licensed properties, and a lot of them tend to have like these horror stories, you know, just everything down to like the actors complaining that, oh, in this one panel you drew me too fat, you know, and now you got to go back and redraw it, you know. So I'd heard all these horror stories, and I was waiting for that kind of that level of like interference, and it didn't really materialize, honestly. Like I did my plot submission. And first, you know, my publisher had to okay, and then it went to the studio guys, and they were fine with it. And then they asked me to, you know, do a more detailed issue-by-issue breakdown, which I did. And there was only, like, one point that they had notes on, you know, it was, like, the relationship between two characters. And it really wasn't that big of a deal. We kind of, like, tried to, not argue, but, like, you know, explain our side and how I saw it, and they weren't going for it. But it wasn't a big deal, so I'm like, okay, that's cool. And really, that was it, and I was really, really surprised that it went that smoothly.
And I'll say, because I've read the book, I own the book, I thought it was a unique take on it, because for those that don't know, I hope I'm not spoiling it, okay, it's a worldwide look at that particular environment. That's how you wrote it.
Yeah.
Rather than, it seems all the movies are geared to USA. This is how it happened in, and even further down into California or wherever they take place. So I thought it was really unique to see that worldwide epidemic, so to speak, going all, you know, global. I thought that was an interesting take. So,
I appreciate it.
Okay, let's maybe back up a little bit, because I know it ties in heavily to your current book, Persia Blues.
Yep.
Talk about growing up in Iran, because, obviously I think that that's a big backdrop to your book, and obviously it made who you are. So, do you mind talking a little bit about that?
No, absolutely. Yeah, so, you know, I was born in Iran. I lived there until I was 12. And I was there prior to the 1979 Islamic Revolution and about 4 years afterwards. So, you know, I sort of experienced both sides of that, the government and the social structure there. Prior to the revolution, obviously, it was, especially where I lived, you know, I lived in the capital in Tehran, so it was very, you know, modern. It was a large metropolitan area, you know, huge population center. And the government at the time, you know, under the Shah, was really trying to sort of promote and push Western sort of ideals and culture and all of that. I'm sure much to the consternation of a lot of people that were there, but also at the same time, it was, you know, it was kind of cool. Aside from the fact that his regime and his government was completely corrupt and completely brutal, you know. But the problem was, after the revolution, things didn't necessarily change for the better. In fact, you know, it probably got worse, because you still had a very oppressive, brutal government, except now, you know, religion is brought into the mix. But anyway, so I kind of, as a kid, even though, you know, I was young enough where I didn't understand all the nuances and stuff, just going through, you know, when the revolution happened and just the complete chaos and not knowing what's going on, you know, the schools being shut down for like months on end and all this stuff. It was kind of crazy, you know, and at the time it seemed normal and sort of like, well, okay, yes, some stuff's going on, but now looking back on it, you know, it's like, holy crap, you know, I can't believe that we're in the middle of all of that.
But there was no, because again, 79, I'm gonna give away my age, I'm 4 years old, I don't know all that's going on within that. So in 79, mm-hmm. was it a brutal, violent, hostile takeover? Transition, I should say, not takeover, but transition. Yeah. And if so, was that found in your neighborhood?
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty turbulent. It was mm-hmm. it was pretty violent. I mean, there were people protesting, and there was like months and months leading up to it.
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
right.
And it was just constant. You know, just mobs of people out in the streets protesting, and the government trying to, you know, suppress it and bringing in the army and all that stuff. And it got pretty violent. You know, there's people that were killed. My parents, obviously, probably like any other parent, you know, they tried their best to shield us. So, you know, mm-hmm. we at the height of it, you know, at the worst parts of it, we pretty much just stayed in the house all the time. Like, we didn't go anywhere. But and I was so when this was happening, I was around 7 years old. So, you know, I remember some stuff, not a whole lot, but some stuff. And I remember, like, just like images here and there. I remember one time we went to pick up my brother from daycare. I have a younger brother. And driving back, I mean, we just were going up the street, and all of a sudden there's just like this mob of people, and there's like smoke because they had piled up tires and set fire to them in the middle of the road, you know. And, you know, my mom's trying to figure out how the heck to get, you know, get out of there, you know.
Yeah, right, yeah. A scary situation having right. a young kid and then you being a young boy as well. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, so there are things like that. But then there's other things where, again, at the time, it, to me, it sort of seemed cool, and I didn't even really think about the ramifications. And then looking back on it, I'm like, holy crap, that was, you know, that's pretty surreal. My cousin, one of my cousins, their house was like one street or like two streets over from where the Shah's palace was in like the northern kind of suburb part of Tehran. And so, of course, you know, there was like a lot of fighting around there, and the Shah had, you know, had fled by this time. But after everything calmed down, I remember like going to visit them because my parents wanted to make sure that they're okay. So then me and my cousins were out on the street, you know, around his house, and we're running around collecting empty shells. I mean, just from like all of the bullets that had been fired everywhere.
Wow.
It's just like handfuls of shells on the sidewalk, and we're collecting them, and we thought, you know, it's really, really cool.
And I'm going to be honest for a minute. I thought you were going to go, my cousin and I went to the Shah's abandoned palace and played all day, because that's where I thought that was going.
That would have been awesome.
That would have been freaking all right. sweet.
All right. So next time I tell this story, I'm going to change it up a little, and that's where it's going to go. But you know, like we're collecting just all of these empty casings and sort of playing with them, and, you know, and as a kid, you don't really think too much about what it all means. But now it's like, wow, that's surreal.
Yeah. So what was, if you don't mind me asking, what was the breaking point where your whole family said, this is enough, we're done, we're out?
Right. You know,
was there one, or it was just the, look, this is not the Persia that we remember, and I'm speaking as your parents, we remember, we need to get out of here, or was there an actual point where they were like, okay, forget this, we're done, we're out?
Yeah, I don't know if there was like a specific incident or there was like one last thing that set it off. You know, it was building kind of to it, because obviously as the years went on and the situation got worse, and they were kind of looking at, well, what kind of future are we going to have in that country?
Right.
You know, the education system was completely gutted. The economy was terrible. The war was going on with Iraq. You know, this was because, you know, pretty soon after revolution is when Iraq attacked, and that war went on for like 8 years or so. So this is like 4 years into it. And by then, they were actually starting to, you know, recruit boys that weren't just 18, but like 17, you know, maybe 16.
Uh-huh.
And there was like this huge push where not so much drafting you, but basically like they were talking these kids into joining the army because they were promising them that if they died, they would be martyrs, you know?
Okay.
And it was just from a pragmatic, kind of realistic point of view. It was just a scary, you know, unstable situation from a, you know, any way that you look at it, you know, from a more long-term viewpoint, it's like, okay, what kind of future are we going to have there? So a lot of these obviously played a role, and my parents are, you know, said, okay, it's time to leave.
And were you the only ones within your particular, I don't know, circle like of friends or family that said we're out too? Or
no, it was pretty much everyone.
It was everyone. Oh, everyone, yeah. Everyone that had a clue was like, we're out of here.
Everyone that could, yeah, everyone that could, you know, manage it somehow. And in that respect, you know, I consider myself very, very fortunate, lucky in that, you know, we were pretty well off financially. You know, we weren't like rich, but both of my parents were Western educated, you know,
okay.
So they had these opportunities to leave. And yeah, I mean, my immediate family, all my cousins, they scattered. I mean, I had cousins that ended up in Belgium, you know, out here in the U.S. in California. We had friends that anywhere that they could go, anywhere that they had family or they knew people or they could get a visa or, you know, any way that they could get out of that country, a lot of them did. And so they just kind of all scattered all over the place. And we ended up in Columbus, Ohio.
Just by happenance, or
no? I had
you had family and friends.
Yeah, here. I had an aunt that lived here
okay.
at the time.
Okay, so
that's yeah.
All right. Okay. So then, let me ask: when did you discover comic books? Is there? Well, you know what? Let me back up for a minute.
Okay.
Are there comic books in Iran? I don't even know that. And excuse my ignorance. I don't know.
I assume
that they're a global phenomenon, but you know, under the tumultuous times of that particular country, were there, and if so, what were they like?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually where I first started with comics, and I probably, you know, discovered them before I could even read. Well, obviously a lot of this stuff was not translated, so, you know, at a young age I couldn't even read if it was in English or French or whatever. But the big like comic scene there both before and after the revolution was European comics.
Okay.
Especially like Tintin. I mean, that was huge.
Okay.
Like,
yeah,
every
yeah.
kid in Iran yeah. knew Tintin, had, you know, all those books. And those actually were, you know, one of the ones that were translated into Farsi.
Okay.
So even from a young age, you know, I could, you know, as soon as I could read, I could read them. So that's sort of what got me into it. And there are a few other ones. There's another, I can't remember if it's French or Belgian comic, but it's called Lucky Luke. It's about a cowboy.
Okay.
That was really huge too. I remember that. And then we would get a, you know, before the revolution, we'd get a smattering of like translated American superhero comics, like the real big names, like Superman and Spider-Man and Batman. And I couldn't tell you if they were like officially translated or if it was really more of a sort of a black market thing.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
I remember having a few copies, and then someone, you know, a friend of a family or somebody, I don't even remember, gave me a stack of like, you know, English comic, American language comics at some point. So I had like X-Men and Richie Rich and, you know, just all of these comics from that.
You know what? I just groaned because I hated Richie Rich.
That's funny. I loved it. I loved it.
I could not stand Richie Rich. He just annoyed him and Casper the Friendly Ghost, because I just found those to be the two most preposterous ideas ever. First of all, a nice rich kid, really?
Right.
And then a ghost that's friendly? Come on.
Now, is this as a kid or is it grown
as
up?
As a kid. No, no, as a kid. Even as a kid, I was like, that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't make any sense. Why? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, All right, so so that's where it officially started. And so when you, what were your favorite titles besides obviously Tintin?
That's really the one that I really remember.
Did you watch the movie? Did you see the movie?
I have not. And you know why? I have this mental block because like I remember the comic so well, and the way that the comic is drawn is like this very clean line, a very classic, you know, very classic style.
Yes.
And I have such a hard time trying to like sit down and watch a 3D CG movie of it, you know? Like if they had animated it in a traditional animation style, I think I would have been excited. And I've heard good things. I've heard it's a good movie. I just haven't brought myself to sit down and watch it.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. So what were some others? Or even today, what are some of the books that you enjoyed?
I mean, that was a big one. Asterix and Obelisk. That was another one that we got like Farsi translations of it. Those were ones that really stick in my mind. Honestly, at the time, like the few American comics and the superhero stuff, I didn't really get into them. Like
when did you get into them? Like
it wasn't until we came to the U.S. Okay. And probably like a year or two after that. So it was probably about mid '80s, I think.
Okay.
when I got into the comics here, and it all started with so mid '80s. They were still around, you know, our neighborhood. The little mom and pop kind of grocery stores and corner drugstores and stuff, you know, they're still around, and they had the spinner racks of comics.
Yep.
So I remember, especially in the summers, you know, when I didn't really have anything to do, I'd just ride my bike down and I'd have a couple of dollars on me. So I'd go through the spinner racks and then just pick stuff that seemed interesting or cool. You know, like I recognized Batman and Superman and Spider-Man. Just about all the other ones were new to me, you know, because like we saw the big names there, but
right
there was no comics.
There was no Rom the Space Knight,
right? Yeah, there's no Rom. There's no Kazar. Or, you know, even X-Men. Like I kind of sort of remember maybe seeing an X-Men comic,
right.
But I had no clue who they were, who all these different characters are.
Right.
So that's sort of how I got started, and then I got hooked, and you know, I was like, I would go back.
Yeah.
And I still didn't have a good concept of. They come out on a monthly, you know, basis, or you can, you know, sometimes they're a mini series, so it ends. Like I would constantly go look for the next issue, and I could never find it. And then years later, I realized, oh, it was just like a 4-issue series, and that was it.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's where I got hooked on them.
That your story is very similar to mine because the same. There was many different influences. One being that corner. So I remember that there was a Rite Aid around quite a bit down the ways from my house, and they had the little spinner rack, and I would go. And I remember I bought an Indiana Jones comic because Marvel had the license for that. They had the Adventures of Indiana Jones. Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham.
Yeah, I remember that.
That was awesome. Star Comics, imprint of Marvel. So that was... And then I won't lie. My other two factors were toys because I was a huge G.I. Joe fan. And the G.I. Joe comic I just gravitated to and loved it more so than the cartoon because it was Larry Hama wrote in a very... realistic manner,
right,
and very complex, and even as a little kid, like I enjoyed that. And then I have a cousin that's been a collector ever since he was 12, and he's quite older than me. And whenever I'd go over to visit my other cousins and my aunt and uncle, he was always reading comics. So I think that you know, I started checking out things. In fact, I think if I remember correctly, he gave me a couple of ElfQuest books. I think,
yeah,
and that's how I got hooked. But very similar. Situation. So, all right. Well, let's talk a little bit about your book because you know, Persia Blues. If I remember correctly, you told me that it's 3 volumes.
Yes.
And so, volume 1 has now just hit the stores.
Yep.
So you need to check it out at your local comic book shop or Barnes and Noble or go to Amazon.com wherever.
Yep.
And check it out. But tell us a little bit, a quick synopsis of what the book's about.
So, you know, one of the things when I was pitching this, the original editor that I pitched it to told me that it's a really hard sell because I can't really distill it into like a one sentence log line, you know, like 30 Days of Night is vampires in Alaska when it's always night. And it's like, that's such a perfect pitch for a movie. And like, everyone gets it.
No, wait, that's bullshit. I'm sorry.
But that's how the business runs.
I know, but that's just such bullshit. Like, how can you take complex ideas and whittle them down to one. I'm sorry, I interrupt. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm outraged by that.
I totally feel the same way. But that's what they want. So, anyways, okay. I could never ever get it down. But so the best that I can and try explain it in like in a few sentences is it's sort of a fusion of modern social commentary and then historical fiction, kind of merged together. So expanding on that a little bit more in terms of the story, it follows a young Iranian woman named Minu who is finishing college in Iran, you know, is sort of sees her future as not going anywhere if she has to stay there, you know, constantly feeling like she has to fight for everything because she's a woman and wanting to, you know, do something more with her life. And so the story follows her as she gets this opportunity to come to the U.S. for grad school. But at the same time, there's a parallel story running through the book that shows her, you know, same character, Minu, in ancient Persia, and she's having these kind of fantastical adventures, and there's like a, you know, I use both like historical, you know, Persian history in it, plus Zoroastrian religion and myths from, you know, our vast, you know, literature. So there's both of these worlds, and she's in both of them. And in the first book, you're still trying to figure out how they relate to each other. And I'm hoping that by the third book, you know, you sort of see that. And then, of course, we'll resolve it in the third book.
All right. Now, you teamed up with Brent Bowman, correct, for the artwork. And how was that, like, working? Did you guys work well together?
Yeah, it worked out really, really well.
But you guys have had experience before, right? Have you guys worked together before? Okay,
yeah,
so you
worked. Why.
So you kind of knew each other right off the bat. Okay,
yeah, I'm in a local writer artist collective called Panel, and we've been around for a little bit over 10 years, I want to say. And Brent is in the same group. He joined about 6-7 years ago, I think. So what we do in the group, you know, is sort of. So it's kind of like a writer's group or, you know, something similar. We get together every other week and everyone brings whatever they're working on and we kind of share it. You know, there's both writers and artists. And, you know, very early on in the group's existence, we sort of just gravitated towards people would work on stories together, would collaborate on little short comic book stories. And we decided, okay, well, since we're doing this, let's just go ahead and put them together and print it in like a, you know, small little self-published anthology book. And it went really well, so we just started doing them twice a year. So we've done, actually, our 20th issue just came out a few months ago. So we've been doing that for about 10 years, and I'd had a chance to work with Brent in that group, you know, on doing little short stories. So when I had the idea for this book and I was looking for an artist, you know, he just seemed like a perfect fit because he's got this style where he can easily switch it up in different kind of art styles.
Okay.
And I, one of the things that early on, once I kind of sort of came up with the basic premise of the book, was I knew I wanted the two settings for the book, the ancient Persia setting and then the modern Iran and modern U.S. settings. I wanted them to be in different art styles to kind of, you know, just parallel the fact that the story is jumping back and forth. And he did it perfectly because, you know, he can do this real clean and traditional, just pen and ink style for the modern stuff. And then he does this beautiful, detailed grayscale, you know, with a lot of pencils and charcoal and you know, grayscale markers and all this stuff for the ancient world. And it's his art, so it's not too jarring. You know, it's not like two different artists doing it and you kind of, it feels it doesn't mesh.
Right.
You know, the characters look the same. It's just that the rendering is a little bit different. And it's been great. And since he's local, it's even better because, you know, a lot of times with most of the stuff I've done, it's, you know, I write the script and the artist lives in a different city or in a different country.
I was going to mention that because Terminator Salvation, the gentleman was clear in another country. Was it Argentina or was it Brazil?
I'm trying to remember. No,
it was South
Argentina.
America. Yeah. And you, so that blew my mind. But, you know, with today's technology, I guess that's the way of things going. But
yeah, and you know, with email and FTP and all that stuff, it's so easy to do, but you don't really get the that sort of personal back and forth and sitting down and talking. And you can try it like on Skype or whatever, but it's not quite the same.
It's not like in Chasing Amy when they're in you know, Banky and Holden are sitting across from one another,
right,
you know, doing their little thing, you know, if you remember that scene.
Yep.
Anyways,
so that made it nice that Brent's, you know, local. Not only do we see each other at least, you know, every other week because we're going to the panel stuff, but whenever we need to, we just get together, you know, after work or on the weekend or whatever. And you show me sketches or, you know, the roughs of the page layouts and we could, you know, talk about it and change things up. And it was great.
Now, I do know from talking with you that there were some issues with getting the book published, and particularly Superstorm Sandy wrecked the offices of the publishing company, correct?
Yeah, and they were, you know, once they were able to get into their office, they didn't have phone service for like a week, and then they didn't have internet service for almost a month, which was ridiculous. So, you know, he would go to like McDonald's or to Starbucks to get, you know, get on their Wi-Fi and get caught up on his emails or do it from home. They couldn't do it from the office, and yeah, it was crazy. And that was like the last thing that I expected to happen because there's all this other stuff we have to do, and it's probably one of the bigger projects I've done.
Sure.
And so, you know, some of this stuff was a little bit new to me, and especially with our publisher, NBM, they're more in the bookstore market. And I've been used to working within the small comic book the market, you know, just selling to the comic book stores, and they carry the comics. And it's they're two very different systems, and it took me a while to kind of wrap my head around, okay, this is how the book market works. You know, their deadlines are way longer, their lead times are a lot longer, and yeah, it was a little tricky at first too.
So, well, which do you prefer now that you've dabbled in both? I mean, are there pros and cons to both?
Pros and cons. I think I still like the comic book market in the sense that it's so much more immediate. You know, I could be working on a script and 3 months later it's on the shelf. You know, it's like such a short time between when I write it and it gets drawn, you know, colored, lettered, printed on the shelf, 3 months, and you're getting feedback. You know,
and actually, you know, there's been lots of other things that you've done, because, you know, you can talk, if you'd like to, let's talk about a couple of those things. You did DC holiday special for last year, was it?
A couple years ago.
You know, you had Lifelike, which was another IDW. What else am I forgetting?
Let's see. So Lifelike, that was, I started as a webcomic, and it was a collection of short stories that I did with different artists, and IDW, you know, collected and put it out as a book. And actually, that's the book that sort of got my foot in the door in terms of the comics publishing world, because IDW started to offer me more projects after that.
Mm-hmm.
And so through them, I did another prequel comic series for Igor, which was an animated, you know, kids movie.
From Disney, or
no? It was I think
I remember it. I remember
It was a smaller studio.
Okay,
and sadly the movie didn't do too well, but I loved it. I thought it was really clever and funny, because it was all like all the characters in that whole story were mad scientists and, you know, like hunchback Igors,
minions.
Basically.
Awesome.
It was just it was a very unique take. Like, there was no funny animals or any of this stuff. And and it had some good voice actors too. I mean, everyone from John Buscemi to John Cusack, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
You know, a bunch of others. But anyway, so I did that through them. Terminator was through IDW, Witch and Wizard was through IDW, and then I did a couple of short autobiographical stories for Dark Horse Presents, and then a couple of projects here and there for Image.
Okay. All right. So you've been around the block a few times.
A little bit,
you will. If you will. All right. So the book's coming out. I know that you have a website for it. You want to plug it real quick before we kind of move on to some other topics real quick?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can check it out at PersiaBlues.com. So the word Persia and then blues, like the musical style, .com.
Can you order it from there?
You can. I have actually a page on there that has links to whatever your preferred method of ordering is. So there's a link to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, your independent bookstore.
Really?
You can get it in digital format. You can get it on the Kindle. You can get it for Comixology. So, yeah, you have a whole bunch of choices.
Gotcha. Will it be at the local Laughing Ogre?
It will be, I believe, next Wednesday.
It'll be on the show. Did they ask you to come in for a signing?
We're going to do a signing, although we're going to wait a little bit. Next week is 4th of July. It gets a little bit crazy, but I actually have another short story coming out in Dark Horse Presents in the July issue. So we kind of thought of combining the signing with those two books coming out.
What's the short story in Dark Horse Presents? Can you talk a little bit about it or no?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this one is a real, real short story. It's a humor or sort of gag strip. Another local artist, Tom Williams... together we created this character called Brainbot Jr. He's the cute little evil genius. So it's sort of like this, it's a little, you know, it's so hard to explain Tom's artwork. Like, people have to see it to get it, and even then they may not get it, because the guy is, his style is so unique and just so like him. But I wanted to do something with Tom, and this seemed like the perfect thing. So the best way that I can explain it is it's surreal, and it's like anarchist style and humor. And it's about this little evil genius that's trying to take over the world. And, of course, his plans never work out.
Which, actually, Brainbot showed up in the back pages of, was it Columbus Melt? What was the name? Melt. Yeah, Columbus Melt, the Free City magazine. Yeah, and then what was the other one that you had with Tim Fisher?
That was the precursor to BrainBot. So we did. So Tim Fisher is another local artist. He has moved out of Columbus since, but he started this panel group. I did, like a one panel gag comic with him in Melt Magazine. It was called Rocket Science.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Okay.
And in that one, we would, we kind of poke fun at pop culture stuff. And then we try to poke fun at Columbus based stuff because Melt was like a, I think they still, I don't know if it's still.
No, I think it's done. Is it done? I haven't seen it in probably 2 or 3 years. It's probably. Oh, okay.
Adios. So yeah, I've been out of it. Like, but yeah, it was like a little
other paper.
It was a little really nicely produced glossy, but like a small size.
Yeah.
Sort of like a digest size magazine. And it was free and it was all just, it was mostly the Columbus club scene. All the bars and clubs and what was going on.
Right, and there was always like a concert that they would highlight that they wrote up and that.
Right. Yeah. And they would do show reviews and that kind of stuff. And we started doing the comic strip in it, and then once Rocket Science ended, I started up doing BrainBot with Tom, and it started out as just like a one panel gag thing. And I, pitched a couple of like 2-3 page stories, to Dark Horse with the character, and they liked it. So yeah.
That's cool. I actually, as a side note, I do have I thought was the best Rocket Science up on my fridge. That you've seen it at my house, the one poking fun at OSU.
Oh yeah,
where they would point to the different Buckeyes on their helmet. I got this one for felonious assault. I got this one for all the different crimes. Yeah. So that was good. Also, not to be outdone, the one with Michael Coleman where he poked fun at.
I gotta say the Michael Coleman one is my favorite. But
for those that don't know, like in 2008, Columbus was in contention to get the GOP convention to come to town, and so Tim had drawn Michael Coleman or a caricature of him, and then in the background was a stage with a stripper pole and like 3 strippers on it with money coming out of their particulars. Yeah. And there was Michael Coleman saying something about, we hope to land the 2008 GOP convention here in Columbus. Do not forget something about small business or something.
Right, and the strippers are like, welcome GOP.
Yeah.
So both of those strips. The thing that's funny about the Coleman one was, a few years ago when that Independence Day Festival started in downtown, I had a booth there and I was selling my comics. And I had some prints made up of a few of those Rocket Science comics, including the Coleman one. And Mayor Coleman came by and he walked by my booth.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And my wife, at the time, we weren't married yet, but she chased him down and gave him a copy. And she's like, you should see this. And he was all confused at first because he's like, is this making fun of me? And I'm like, no, really, I'm kind of making fun of Republicans. But, so that always sticks in my mind. And then the one that you liked, the OSU one, was the only strip that we did that we ever got emails on. Like, it was kind of just
hate mail.
Yes.
You got hate mail?
Yes, got hate mail.
You sons of bitches, don't you know? Really?
Yep.
Wow.
So it made me feel good because the other ones, we'd do these strips and no one would ever say anything. We'd get no email, no feedback whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of disheartening a little bit.
Right, sure.
But then, on that one, we got like 2 or 3 hate mails. I'm like, yes, we did it.
Awesome. That's good stuff. Yeah. All right, so BrainBot coming up, Dark Horse.
Yeah.
I cannot believe your wife did that. But wait a minute, didn't you get to go to oh no, that was the governor's mansion that you got to go to.
Yep.
Okay. You want to talk about that real quick, what that was for, since I brought it up?
Yeah, that was
For small press, wasn't
it?
Ago.
It was for, there's a yearly book festival here called Ohioana Book Festival.
Yes, yeah.
And there's the Ohioana Library is at the State House, I want to say. And basically it's a library of works created by Ohio residents. So they have music and
Of Blues be in there?
It'll be in there. All my other books are in there.
Sweet. So. All right.
So they have, so every year they hold this book festival where they have, all these Ohio artists and writers, I should say, they're, selling their books, and they'll have panel discussions and all this kind of stuff. And then at the end of the day, on Saturday, they invite all the writers to the governor's mansion for like a sort of a meet and greet cocktail hour thing.
Would that be, that's Kasich was the governor at the time, or no, was it Teddy Strickland?
It was Strickland.
It was Strickland.
Yeah, this was, this was, I want to say 3 years ago.
Right.
So yeah, it was Strickland. Right. So I got to go, and it was kind of cool, you know, just to see it. And yeah. I didn't meet him. His,
did he send a lackey?
No, no. The thing was, his wife was very involved with the library.
Okay.
And I think that's how the tradition got started of them hosting.
Oh, okay.
You know, all the writers after the show. All
right.
So she was there. But, you know, it was just like, it was cool to see that. I mean, the mansion, it's like a nice mansion, but the gardens are beautiful. And it was, weather was nice. So we were outside and they had, you know, free food and booze and all that. So, you know, how can you
do
that?
Did you go, hello, governor?
Did you do if that? I had met him.
You would have?
I wouldn't have.
All right. Anyways. You know,
I don't have the cojones for that.
All right, well, let's jump into some of the things that you're a fan of in terms of comic books right now. What are you reading? What artists or writers do you find to be intriguing, fascinating, etc.?
Right. Oh, man. This is one I should have prepared for because I always forget, like, if I'm trying to think off the top of my head. So, to be totally honest, over, like, the last year or two, my reading has dwindled. And part of it is when I was working on the book, I just had no free time because all of my free time was going into the book. And part of it, too, was aside from the fact that there was a lot of research and all that stuff involved in the writing, I also lettered it. And I'm not a professional comic book letterer. I know enough to do a decent job, but I'm slow at it. So lettering a 102-page graphic novel took forever for me and ate up all my free time.
Not to break kayfabe, if you will, you also have a regular job too.
Yeah,
because you know it just like
right.
You know you're not.
this is on top of the 40 hours. Yeah, or whatever
I was gonna say. Yeah,
put in the office.
You're not independently wealthy. Yeah. You know, so yeah, okay.
The
so
comics aren't paying the bills.
Right, right.
So yeah, so I mean, partly because of that, my reading kind of dwindled, and also I don't know. There's just over the last few years, the way the industry is going and just the way that the publishers are working, it's just a little disillusioning and just kind of sad, I guess. But all of that aside, stuff that I'm reading. So from the big two, I'm really, really enjoying Scott Snyder's writing on Batman. Mm-hmm. I mean, I before DC rebooted their whole line and you know, he took over the Batman book, prior to that, he was doing Detective Comics, and it was actually during that time period where Bruce Wayne was lost back in time, and so he wasn't Batman, and Dick Grayson was Batman. But he did such a kick-ass job. I mean, the writing was so good and so tight. And now that he's doing the regular Batman book, I mean, it's just really, really good. So I'm totally digging that. I'm mostly a DC guy, you know, even though the number of books has dwindled, but Batwoman is another book I like, and that one I like mostly for the art. When J.H. Williams is drawing it, he's off doing a Sandman miniseries, so right now they have a different artist in, but that guy's layouts, man, it's just, it blows my mind. And it's so funny because the writing's not bad, but it's a little what's the word, a little spare, you know, there's not a lot there.
Who is the writer on that?
He writes it as well.
With
a co-writer.
Okay. All right.
So you kind of notice it when like somebody else is drawing the book. You're like, oh, you know, that was enjoyable, but you kind of read through it in 15 minutes and you're done.
Yeah, right.
But then when he's drawing it, it's still the same, but like you take 45 minutes looking through it because his artwork is just beautiful. And he just does constant like two-page layouts where it's not a two-page splash page. It's, you know, panel layouts, but he designs the entire page around the action. Like there was in a recent storyline, you sort of had Batwoman and Wonder Woman team up, and there's a scene where they're in a maze, and he designed this double page spread where you're kind of looking at it from above with them in the maze, and the entire page is like all of the twists and turns of the maze.
Wow.
As the characters go through it, you know.
Wow.
It's just, yeah,
amazing.
Really gorgeous stuff. He does beautiful layouts. So I'm totally digging that book. There's a book from Dark Horse called The Massive that Brian Wood is writing. And I'm liking that. It's sort of like a set in the future after a big environmental disaster. And, you know, sea level has risen and most of the countries are sort of in ruins and.
Is that a superhero-based book or no?
Nope,
it's more of a reality-based kind of book.
Yeah. They're hinting at, you know, one of the characters, and maybe there's more to her than just a regular human being, but for the most part, it's a very grounded series. And I'm liking that. Let's see, what else? Yeah, see, this is where I draw a blank.
Well, so then,
One other one I should mention. The Unwritten, that's coming out from, it's actually issue 50 just came out. It's a Vertigo book.
Okay.
And Mike Carey writes that, and he's great writer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He ran, he had a very big run on Hellblazer, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think he did the X-Men for a while.
Right.
Yeah, he's...
He's been around. Stuff. Yeah, he's been around for a while. Then I guess I'm going to stump you then by asking you best comic book ever.
Wow.
Or top three. If you don't want to go that far, I mean top three.
Top three, huh? So, in my personal top three, I always say Moonshadow.
Okay.
Which came out back when Epic Comics started.
You're right.
You remember that?
Right. Yeah.
It was a miniseries through them, and then Vertigo reprinted it, many years later. But that book, the writing by J.M. DeMatte is just awesome. It was one of the first like adult comics that I'd read in mm-hmm. the sense that it was intended for, grown-ups. And then the artwork, it's all watercolor by John J. Muth, and it's just beautiful. So that book I love. Honestly, like just sort of like the big classics that everybody else talks about. I'm love Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns. Actually, his Daredevil run. I'm trying to remember the name of the arc now. It's gonna bug me because I know it. I have the book down there. But when he was working on Daredevil and the story arc where David Mazzucchelli drew it. Oh well. I'm sure it'll come to me at some point. That goes up. So I probably have five or six in my top three. Those.
All right. I gotcha.
Watchmen I love, but I kind of like V for Vendetta more as a story. Watchmen I like just because that was the first time when I realized that, oh, there's stuff that you can do in comics that you really can't do in other medium. Like the way he plays around with the panel structure and the way that they'll have an action going on and there will be captions, but the captions have nothing to do with what the action is going on. It has something to do with the conversation, but they meld well together,
Right. Right.
Stuff like that, It's like I guess you could do it in a movie with a voiceover, but it would sound cheesy and it would look weird.
And Watchmen's on my top list because I think the same way was I found it interesting how that you would shift gears. Like there were constantly backstory that was thrown in the middle of things, but I liked that. And I read it when I read it, it literally blew my mind because again, I was like, that was the first adult comic that I read, and I was like, well, you can get away with this,
right?
Murdering and killing and raping and whatnot. I say that. I was always a big fan of X-Men, God Loves, Man Kills.
Yeah.
With Chris Claremont. Yeah. That was always a favorite of mine. Preacher, that book I found to be by Garth Ennis, really, really well done. And again, out there, but yet I just gravitated to it. I don't know why. So I think those would be top three on my list. I mean, unless you consider, Transmetropolitan. Spider Jerusalem, Warren Ellis, very good, very good story there. So, gotcha.
Yeah, Sandman and Bone. I have to add those. And Bone, a lot of it has to do with the fact that just knowing that Jeff Smith is a Columbus guy, and here's a guy that created this immensely huge and popular series that's been reprinted in just about every language and
all over
the world. And,
right.
He's still a Columbus guy. You still see him around town, and it's just it's just so cool.
Yeah, I would throw Mouse on there as well.
Yeah.
I mean, just for the heaviness of that whole story and the fact that it's factual too, I'd throw that in my top 10, top 5, whatever.
It's hard. It's so hard. It's
so hard. You're right. Yeah,
they're all so different.
I'm thinking of on a totally cheesy way. Shogun Warriors was a favorite of mine, like the first story arc, because it was cheesy, but as a little kid, I gravitated towards it.
Right.
Plus, I had my first three issues of that signed by Jim Shooter.
Oh, well, there you go. The Jim Shooter.
He was the editor-in-chief. I was like, I had nothing for him to sign at a Comic-Con one time, and I go, I'm going to take Shogun Warriors, because that would be sweet. And when I handed it to him, he goes,
I go, sir, could you sign these for me? Because you have to understand, as a kid, these were some of my very first comics I ever bought, and they were favorites of mine. Yeah. And he was like, you know what? That's pretty cool. We'd love to sign them. And so, you know.
He's an interesting dude. I know, like, within the comics world, almost he's hated almost universally. But, and, you know, I don't know all the stories. I don't know what part's true, what's not. But I can't imagine he's as bad as, you know, everyone talks
about.
Well,
who's worse, Jim Shooter or Dan DiDio? Or how do you pronounce it? Because let's be honest, DiDio gets thrown on the bus for lots of questionable decisions. The mere fact that they've created a website has DC... What's it? I don't even know. It's so long, I don't remember. But it's basically...
What has DC...
Messed up today,
or
something like that.com. Like, yeah, and you click on it, it's like, yeah. It's been 8 days since DC Comics has screwed anything up. Well, hey, you know,
yeah, honestly, you know, like when you're in that position, especially now, I mean, now that Marvel's owned by Disney and you know, DC it had been owned for the longest time by Time Warner, or whatever, but
well, they still are, aren't they?
They still are, but okay. It's been more recent that Warner has sort of woken up and realized, oh, holy crap, we own DC Comics, you know?
Oh, okay, gotcha, yeah. So.
But yeah, I mean, especially now, those guys, their job, like, I do not envy them their jobs. I would never, ever in a million years want to be in that position, because these are billion-dollar intellectual properties that they are in charge of, and it doesn't matter what, you know, readers want to read or what the creators, you know, want to do. What matters is Disney says, hey, you got to position, you know, X character because we want to make Y movie with them, you know.
Right, yeah.
And we're going to invest $200 million in making a movie, and we expect it to make $1 billion. So, no, you can't, like, just kill them off because you think it would be a good storyline, you know. So
right.
I think their hands in a lot of ways are tied. Now, in terms of how they work with the talent, I mean, that's like you mentioned, the whole DC thing. I mean, that's been in the news lately a lot.
Well, James, I think I read a couple weeks ago, then James K. Robinson say, forget this, I'm out.
Yeah,
I mean, he quit.
He's only like the 10th or 12th to leave.
Well, no,
you know?
Right,
so,
yeah,
you know,
but,
so,
I mean, he's the most recent, I think.
Right, yeah.
Like, you know,
so there's
yeah.
something going on, obviously.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
So that stuff, they could handle better, but I don't know.
What do you think the future holds for comics? Do you think we'll always have the physical comic? You know what I mean? Because to me, there's nothing like quite holding the book. Like, I don't have a Kindle. I don't have a Nook or any of that stuff because to me, even with books,
right.
like, I like to hold them. There's something about it. It's, I don't know, you can call me old, you can call me antiquated, whatever, but to me, there's just something about holding it.
I'm totally the same way. I mean, I totally like the tactile, you know, just holding that book or whatever in your hand.
Right.
But at the same time, I know that our kind is growing up and dying, and the generation behind us could care less about that. They're more than happy to read it, not just on their Nook or their Kindle, but on their tiny ass little phone. You know, like, they're fine with that.
Yeah, right.
Which
sure.
boggles my mind. It's like, why would you want to? But that's where everything's going. So I don't know. I honestly don't know if 5 years from now they're still going to be printing comics.
Well, I'm going to try it out because I just procured issues 1 through 40 of The Walking Dead in PDF form. I've never read a comic like that. I mean, it's always been, as you said, in my hands. So I'm curious to see how that goes for me. I don't know. I'm not making a joke of that. I'm concerned, like,
oh, I know.
You know, like, I'm just not going to be the same. I don't know if I'm going to have the same. I'll probably end up just getting rid of those and going to the store and buying the graphic novels rather than, you know, necessarily scrolling through them or whatever you want to call it, you know.
I know.
So,
I mean, heck, I've got my, I mean, both Persia Blues and Lifelike, you know, I have digital versions of them. And even I don't really like to look, you know, I look at them just to see what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the tablet, but I can't read them. I've downloaded some, you know, free comics from DC and Marvel and other places, and I've tried it, and it's just not my thing. It's hard for me to get into that.
Gotcha. Well, as we're starting to approach the 55-minute mark here as I look, let's start to kind of wrap things up. Tell everybody out there where they can find out about you, Persia Blues, Panel, Ferret Press, all that stuff.
All that stuff. All right, so Persia Blues is easy. Like I said, PersiaBlues.com. and all the information's on there about the book. There's previews of it. You can read, I think there's like the first 13 or so pages you can read. There's a blog that, you know, we kind of get into the behind the scenes making of and a lot of the process stuff, and then links to where you can buy it. My personal website is just my name. Oh, sorry, I'm losing my voice here.
It's all right. It's all right. It happens to the best of us.
All right. Hopefully it's better. Yeah, so daranaragi.com. And then...
We didn't talk about Ferret Press. We really haven't talked. Let's dabble into that, because I threw it out there, and then I was, in my head I was like, oh, crap, we haven't even talked about that, because that's just another avenue to your creative life.
That's sort of... So when I first started... writing comics and self-publishing them, I wanted like an imprint, and I just said the air quotes, by the way. So we started with the air quotes, we're gonna end with them.
All right,
so I like the symmetry of that. No, I wanted like a label to print my stuff under, and I came up with excuse me, I came up with Ferret Press.
So why, okay, while you're taking a sip of water, why Ferret Press? Like, that, I guess, is the question. You didn't have a pet ferret.
I did, actually.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
did you? All right.
I did.
Okay, that's where it came up.
So that's where it came from.
Okay.
And that's also the panel anthologies that I was talking about. That's what we print them under.
Okay.
Is under Ferret Press.
And that's ferretpress.com?
Yep.
Okay. All right, well, with that, I'm going to kind of wrap this up as I do every week.
All right.
And that's with Orlando's faves. It's kind of like Oprah's faves, only A, my stuff is cooler, and B, I don't give the shit away.
Right.
But it's something throughout the week that I found that's cool or whatnot, and I guess that I owe this Orlando's fave to my stepfather, because... my fave this week is the Compact Presario 2100 laptop that I received. It was a hand-me-down from stepdad.
This one right here?
This one right here.
Very nice.
I know. I know. It's old. I know. It's it's an antique. I know. But so I give props to my stepdad for, believe it or not, they got iPads. Mom and my stepdad, and
so
he
they
was
got
like,
rid of their laptop.
Right. They're like, I'm getting rid of this thing. And I have a friend that's an IT wizard. And so they gave it to me, and for like $50, he totally got it up running and sort of geeked out. It doesn't have all the bells and whistles, but it's doable for taking the PVD cast on the road.
Your mobile tactical unit right there.
That sounds very 24-like, Jack Bauer.
You're welcome.
Anyways. Well, Dara, I appreciate you coming on. I hope that the book sells millions and millions of copies.
Thank
and
you.
Maybe when Volume 2 is ready to drop, we'll have you come back on, or... heck, as I invite anyone that sits here next to me and talks with me and the people listening at home, you can always come back anytime.
Awesome.
So with that, though, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to tell you where you can get in touch with me. You can follow me at Twitter at PVDMVP, or if you would like to shoot me an email, you can do so by going to PVDcast@mail.com. Those are the two ways you can get in touch with me. Dara, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. And I will talk at each and every one of you later. Thanks for listening.